It's Ideasphere with writer Helen Thorpe, Soldier Girls.
I learned so much from them about what it meant to be in the military, about what struggles they faced as veterans returning back to civilian society. There was so much about their deployments that I had not understood previously.
In her new book, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, writer Helen Thorpe provides a detailed account of what happened to these three GIs during the last decade. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Ms. Thorpe follows the lives of three women over 12 years. We learn what prompted them to join in the first place, what it was like to be in the combat zone in Afghanistan, and how they struggled with a return home. Helen Thorpe is a staff writer for the New York Observer, New Yorker, and Texas Monthly. Her stories have aired on This American Life and Soundprint. And she's my guest for this program. Ms. Thorpe, thanks for joining the show.
You're welcome.
For whatever reason, women in the military has been a controversial subject for as long as it's been discussed. But you've chosen to follow these three women over quite a period of time.
In my first book, I followed four women over a six-year period of time. And in this recent book, I'm following three women during two deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq. I was really interested in the experience of veterans coming back from the two wars. I know that it's hard for people to transition home after a deployment, and I was really curious about that experience. And I started interviewing different veterans. And I came across this one young woman. In the book, she's identified as Michelle Fisher, which is actually a pseudonym.
Yes.
But right away, she just leapt out at me. She was really funny, extremely smart. She didn't fit the stereotypical idea of a soldier at all. She had voted for Ralph Nader in the previous presidential elections. She opposed the wars. She felt she was very different in terms of her political beliefs than her colleagues in the National Guard. But she also felt that her deployment to Afghanistan was one of the most meaningful experiences of her life. And she forged really strong relationships with other women in the National Guard. And I began to think of her as somebody who, I think there are a lot of readers who might never pick up a military history or might never want to read a book about the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq, and yet they could identify with this young woman who just wanted to go to college and signed up for the Guard, not expecting ever to deploy. And then when 9/11 happened, of course, her life was much different than she had imagined.
The lives of these women you've chosen to write about, each one of them has reached this stage in their lives where they know they need some financial assistance, and so they choose
right.
What might be the best route.
Yeah. In many ways, this is a book about trying to climb out of poverty. And Michelle Fisher, at age 18, her parents had always done factory jobs, that kind of work. Her mom was sometimes on and off welfare. Her dad was sometimes in and out of jail. And she really wanted a different kind of life, and she couldn't figure out how to make that happen. She was trying to pay her own way through community college, but it was really hard. And she was very, very smart and felt she could go to a better university if only she could afford the tuition. And that was her motivation to sign up for the Guard. And in the case of her good friends, Desma Brooks and Debbie Helton, each of them signed up looking for an extra paycheck and also a way to make their lives more meaningful.
And to gain tuition for their college of choice.
Exactly. Each of them did end up using the GI Bill at various points in their lives, and that was really the primary motivation, particularly for Michelle.
Not many of us are really aware, and your book is helpful in this manner, of the challenges. We hear constantly about how women are abused, raped in the service, and we don't know the background that might enter the typical mind is, why are they in there in the first place?
One of the things that was really enlightening for me, speaking with Michelle, Debbie, and Desma over the years that we were doing our interviews that led to this book, was hearing about the general atmosphere in terms of relations between the genders while they were overseas. I'd heard all the statistics around military sexual trauma, the assaults on women that had occurred on posts during the two wars, but I couldn't really make sense of those statistics. I couldn't understand why was it happening. But when they began to describe the atmosphere they found themselves in, it all began to make more sense. They were serving in a mixed gender battalion, but they were always in the minority. And when they were deployed, they were living on a post alongside of other military units that were primarily all male. So the ratio of men to women was extremely skewed, and women were viewed as a very scarce commodity, really, by the men. They were objectified. They were always being hit on. The men were vying to see who could have relationships with the women. And in this sort of overheated atmosphere, and everybody was scared and stressed out at the same time, and you know, in this sort of overheated atmosphere, the attention that they would get from their male colleagues was almost overwhelming. And you began to understand, particularly as the wars would drag on and there were multiple deployments and people were being asked to leave their families behind, you could start to understand the atmosphere in which these assaults were taking place.
Obviously, it's going to happen with the situation of a man being in a condition where he's surrounded by other men and there are a few women in the camp. But in so many cases, this goes way over the top. And what we may be surprised about is how the superiors, senior officers above these women, don't have any, in many cases, don't have parameters.
Yeah, there's a guy in their battalion who takes a liking to Michelle Fisher. He is older and he is above her in the chain of command. And he does things, they're not assault, but she finds them objectionable, his behavior. He does things like during their annual training, he will put his cot directly next to hers in the middle of the night while she's sleeping so that when she wakes up, she finds her face only inches away from his. Or when she's pulled overnight guard duty and she has to stay up all night keeping watch, he'll come sit with her even though he didn't have guard duty, and as her superior, he wouldn't really be assigned to that normally, and it's not really where he belongs. So she found it hard to sort of keep him at bay, and she was often sort of sending off men who she didn't really want to be with in that sort of a way.
I think what's going to surprise readers, too, is how blatantly honest these women are about their experiences.
So we spoke over a number of years. I met Michelle first in early 2010, and she soon introduced me to her friends Desma and Debbie. And when we were speaking at first, the subject matter was typically what had their lives been like before the National Guard, what led them to enlist. Over time, I think we developed a lot of trust, and they started telling me more stories about some things that had happened that they didn't reveal initially. And I think they wanted to understand how I would receive Desma, for example, during her deployment to Afghanistan, chose to, with her full consent, have an affair with a married man who was her superior officer. So it's explicitly banned by the military. This type of relationship is not supposed to happen because since he has authority over her, he shouldn't be having a relationship with her. But she wanted to have a relationship with this guy, even despite the fact that it was banned and that he was married. So she got through her deployment that way. It was almost a coping mechanism is how she came to think of the relationship that they had while they were deployed. And she did confide fully. It was something that I don't think, you know, she understood fully that she was doing something that was breaking the rules, that other people would find objectionable, that other people in her own unit didn't think was a great thing to be doing. But I think we had established enough trust that she was able to share fully her motivations for doing that, why it happened, and to talk about then how that relationship ended once they got back to the United States.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with author, journalist Helen Thorpe, Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War. This is now available in hardcover from Scribner Press. I'd like you to give your website, anything else, blog, tweet, or anything you would like to share with your listeners now.
Sure. My website can be found at www.helenthorpe.com. And there are reviews of the book up there, and you know, a little biography and ways that you can get in touch. And I also have similar material up on Facebook. And on Amazon, there's an author profile with similar information as well. So there's multiple ways to learn more.
Excellent. We'll have that posted at Public Radio Exchange if you've missed this. If you're tuning in late, there are a couple of ways you can retrieve the audio through National Public Radio's home site, npr.org, under Ideasphere, or go to Public Radio Exchange, prx.org. Soldier Girls, a read that's going to take you through the hills and valleys of these women's lives during deployment to Iraq and Afghanistan. The hills and valleys I'm thinking of are the challenges mentally that these women faced. And it's not unusual for any of us when we're in stressful conditions to question ourselves as to why we're there. You find that these young women are doing no differently, but perhaps it seems more often.
You know, I think that one of the things that really intrigued me about these three women, in addition to their relationships with each other and how those relationships gave them each a lot of support, was how different they were from one another. So on the one hand, there was Michelle Fisher, who had voted for Ralph Nader, didn't believe in the wars, and was very, very upset to have been deployed. And then her very close friend and a fellow member of the weapons team, that they're fixing broken weapons, Debbie Helton, is a woman who is 30 years older than Michelle. She's been in the National Guard for 15 years already at the point when 9/11 happens. She helped integrate women into that National Guard unit originally. She views the deployment as the highlight of her life. It's literally the most thrilling thing that has ever happened for her. Her day job, she's been working as a beautician for decades, and she likes that work, but she finds her service in the Guard much more fulfilling, and she really, really wants to serve her country overseas. She wants the chance to see another country, to experience a foreign country, but also to the idea of service she finds deeply fulfilling. So they have really polar opposite responses to being deployed. When they get there, they each find the deployment stressful. It's not as though Debbie finds it easy, but she's happy to be there. Desma, who is in between Michelle and Debbie age-wise, is somebody who voted for George Bush, supports the war in Afghanistan, isn't sure that the U.S. has the manpower for a second war, but does understand Saddam Hussein to be a problematic leader, so she has kind of a nuanced response to the war in Iraq. She supports most of Bush's positions, particularly the war in Afghanistan, and when she's serving in Afghanistan, it's not as though it's violating her belief system to find herself there, but she's a single mom with three kids. So personally, it is just incredibly hard for her to leave her children behind for a year and feel like a good mother at the same time. So she's always like trying to find a quiet corner of the post to make a cell phone call to one of her kids. She's trying to like buy birthday presents or Christmas gifts online, make sure they arrive at the right time. She's trying to manage her civilian commitments and her military commitments, and they're just at odds at this point.
You mentioned something there so interesting, is how these young women, so polar in their philosophical beliefs and personal lives, and yet they are very close personal friends now.
Yeah. They didn't immediately become personal friends when they first met. I mean, they went through a few annual trainings, just getting to know each other and liking each other and finding each other's personalities interesting. But they had so many differences. If they had remained at home in the United States, maybe those differences would have meant they would never become close. But once they deployed to Afghanistan and they spent a year in Afghanistan together, the differences that had seemed big in the United States just melted away. It didn't matter anymore who they had voted for in the presidential election or who they were going to vote for that fall, in the fall of November 2004, when there would be another election. It mattered much more when Michelle found herself sharing a tent with Desma, even though Michelle had voted for Ralph Nader and Desma had voted for George Bush. They had more similar personalities in terms of how they chose to deal with their deployment, how they chose to get through that period of time, than did the other women in the tent. So they were both rebelling. They were finding ways to get prescription pills, or they were finding ways to date men, or they were, and the other women in the tent were viewing their behavior as problematic. Mm-hmm. And so they were sort of the troublemakers in the tent, and they bonded together over that. They were both extremely good at their jobs, I should add. So they're very conscientious when they were at work, but then once they were finished, Desmo was working at the motor pool while Michelle was fixing broken weapons. When they finished their work, they would sort of sneak around and do things they were not necessarily meant to be doing. And Desmo had a really colorful sense of humor, so she ordered like 50 pink flamingos to put around their tent to liven things up in this very drab army post. That the fact that they handled their deployment similarly, that mattered more once they were in Afghanistan. So along similar lines, Michelle and Debbie were working together, and they just found they had a common sense of humor. And Debbie was mothering or mentoring or supporting this younger woman, Michelle, all of the time. And Michelle came to really lean on her and rely on her. So even though Michelle was sort of anti the two wars, and she believed in her fellow veterans, but she didn't believe in the wars they were fighting. And then Debbie didn't have that sort of complication in her worldview. She was very in sync with the goals of the military and very happy to be there and comfortable with her deployment. Those differences were less important once they were together in Afghanistan, because every morning when Michelle got up, Debbie was happy to see her and said warm, supportive things to her while they were working and kept her happy throughout the day. And that was just the only thing that was important once they found themselves there.
And am I guessing here correctly when I'm thinking something you just said about the sense of humor? There were also the pranks. This is a stress release, something that can make life feel normal in very stressful conditions.
Yeah. There's this moment, it's actually right before their deployment to Afghanistan, when Michelle realizes that she might really want to become friends with this woman, Desmo Brooks. And it's when Desmo pulls a prank that Michelle just thinks is hilariously funny. So Desmo was working as a supply clerk, and it was during the weeks when they were mobilizing, getting ready to go. So they had already left their civilian lives behind. They were wearing a uniform every day, but they were still in the United States getting their equipment organized and getting ready to go overseas. So because she was working in supply, Desmo had access to ordering anything that the U.S. military stocked. And she decided to sort of have some fun with this because she was really angry about the deployment and didn't want to leave her children for a year. So she decided one day to organize a party and order, which nobody had authorized her to do. So she ordered a lot of hot dogs and hamburger meat and buns, and she tried ordering beer, and then she decided it would be much more fun if she could order a Clydesdale horse. She orders all this stuff, and some of it got through the ordering process, but the Clydesdale horse
could
not.
Yeah. I wonder why.
But the story that she had tried ordering a horse, you know, made its way through the barracks, and that was when Michelle was like, I can get through this deployment if I get to hang out with somebody who's ordering a horse when they're not supposed to.
Soldier Girls, The Battles of Three Women at Home and at War, writer Helen Thorpe. Her website, helenthorpe.wordpress.com. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rathbun. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Chris Tomlinson, Tomlinson's Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. This may be a rather tough question, but there is an answer here for understanding America's racism. We are one of very few nations left that has this built into our society.
We have a major problem with race in America, and it's something that we have to deal with. And I know there are a lot of people with a lot of ideas on what to do. I think part of the reason why this continues to be a problem is that we have a dominant population that doesn't want to talk about the past, who wants to continue to hold up their ancestors with a sense of pride. In Texas, we have a group, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, who want to put the Confederate battle flag on our license plates of our cars. And that boggles my mind, because by doing so, by celebrating their racist ancestors, they're denying 14% of the population their history and their suffering during that history. And as long as that kind of thing persists, I think we're going to consistently see racism as a problem in our society.
It seems to me that addressing it through that level, saying that this is a symbol of our society, that is the Confederate flag, is denying that it is also the symbol of what is wrong with our society.
There are a lot of people who find, like me as a child, a great deal of self-esteem in the accomplishments of their ancestors. And genealogy and tracing your family is an exciting hobby. It's like unraveling a mystery, and we'll tell you some things that are exciting. I found that it's so much more satisfying and engrossing to know the full story, to know the whole history, to understand that my family were pioneers in the settlement of Texas, and they contributed to the Texas economy, and they fought for what they believed in the Civil War, while also acknowledging that they were on the wrong side of history, that they chose to defend a system that was indefensible, a system that they knew was wrong. My ancestors, in their letters, took great pains never to use the word slave. They used the word Negroes instead, because it was an uncomfortable word for them. They read in the newspaper every day about abolitionists who were making biblical and constitutional arguments against slavery. So to me, that's a valuable lesson of how each one of us has to maintain a moral code that we're going to stick to. And just because our relatives or our society tells us to go one way, we have to stick to our guns. And there were people who did that in Falls County. My great-grandfather's father-in-law fled Texas at the beginning of the Civil War because he opposed slavery, and he became a Union soldier and fought against the South, and then came home to Texas and helped to establish what he had hoped would be a more race-neutral society in the South. That failed, but that's an example of someone who bucked the trend. And so I can be proud of both, you know, and I find it. And I challenge people who really only want to believe in that one thing and ignore the rest, that they're denying themselves an opportunity.
There's a key here, too, and you mentioned that your ancestor came back to Texas in an effort to reconcile, and it failed. Part of that failure was so wrapped up in America's efforts to try to appease the South and bring them back into the fold of the United States. And in so doing, the Supreme Court undermined everything that had been established at the end of the Civil War.
The North really wanted to get the economy buzzing again, and they wanted to get the politics solved. And while they made a good, solid 7-year effort at Reconstruction and use the Freedmen's Bureau to try to instill civil rights across the South. They didn't have enough money. The Civil War had bankrupted both sides. They needed to demilitarize and demobilize the Civil War soldiers. So, yes, when faced with the enormity of the task of trying to turn the South into a multiracial civil rights society, they gave up and went with political expediency. And that led to Jim Crow laws and segregation and the systematic denial of political and economic rights to Black people. And frankly, my great-grandfather was a part of that as a politician and as a county-level official in Falls County to try to make sure that they imposed slavery by another name.
Have you gone beyond this book now with your work? Is it taking on a life of its own unexpectedly?
You know, after working on a book like this for 7 years, you know, you get lost in it. You get buried in it, and you come to the assumption that everybody knows what you know, and that is my book really going to say anything that new? You know, because I'm building on the work of so many wonderful authors and historians to pull this together. But I'm surprised at the reception that it's getting and the interest in it. I'm encouraged by it. I'm a business columnist for the Houston Chronicle. I try to be a moral voice for the business community in Texas. And I guess the lessons I learned about the need for voices to demand good behavior is one that I take with me into my daily work today.
Where do you go from here? You've written this book. You've set up a website bringing people together.
I think I'm going to continue to shout from every megaphone that I can get a hold of for people to know their history, to read this book and to read others like it, to understand how we got to where we are today. It's a good news story. I mean, this book ends with LaDainian and I working together on it. It ends LeVar Tomlinson, a Black man, and I going to the Lincoln Memorial together and standing at the spot where Dr. Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech about the sons of slaves and the sons of slaveholders coming together in brotherhood. So, you know, I think for those who really don't want to dredge up the past, I would tell them that you'll be much more excited about today and the future, if you know how far we've come. The lessons for us are on how to move forward are in the past. All we have to do is open our eyes to them.
And as you wrap up your work with the more familiar, and I'm summarizing this in a paraphrasing, the more familiar we are with something, anything, the more comfortable we are with it.
That's right. That's right. You know, there are neuroscientists who are doing tests about the biology of bigotry. And, you know, they've traced it to the fight or flight mechanism in our brains that kept us alive when we were being hunted saber-toothed tigers, or when we were living in tribes and on the African plains trying to eke out an existence. And what we know is, yes, you know, fearing people who are not like us is part of our survival instinct, but we have to be taught who are the people that are not like us. And when we teach our children that skin color is not the way to determine whether someone is with us or against us, we win. And the most exciting thing is that neuroscientists have discovered that part of the brain can be retrained in a matter of days just by, you know, building friendships, working as teams, coming together to accomplish something that's bigger than us as individuals. And those old beliefs fade away.
Well, Mr. Tomlinson, thank you so much for your time. I sincerely appreciate this effort and what you're accomplishing.
Thank you so much for giving me a chance to talk about it.
We will, I hope, talk again sometime soon.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you. My guest has been Chris Tomlinson, business columnist for the Houston Chronicle. For more than 20 years, he's reported from around the world and has served as the East Africa Bureau Chief for the United Press. His stories covered the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. Check out his website at TomlinsonHill.com. His book, Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.